Call the Capital Investment Committee to order. The clerk will take the roll. And today we'd like to welcome President Brimmicks to committee. Thank you for taking time out of what we know is an extremely busy schedule at the university to come over and go through some of your capital investment requests. And so with that, we will turn it over to you, Mr. President.
Okay. Thank you, Chair Kroenke, members of the committee, and thank you for the invitation to visit with you today about the university's capital request for 2004. It's an honor to be here and to present our request. I'd like to start with a few just preliminary comments about the university and the request to frame our discussion, and then take a little time to walk you through the different parts of the request, and I suspect we'll have ample time for questions and comments. The first point I'd like to make by way of introduction is that I believe the university this year and has submitted a request that truly states and presents the university's most urgent capital investment needs. Is modest in scope and I think critical not only to the university but the state in general. There are many people of the executive team here today, members of the faculty who can answer questions during our question and answer period. I do not believe there are members of the Regents here this afternoon.
President Brooks, did you want to recognize those individuals?
Well, there's so many of them. I think that we packed the house this afternoon. So.
But at least on the right side, it's packed.
On the,
I've not noticed.
Well, they're to my left. But since I'm the more moderate member of the team, but anyway, let me make just a couple of really quick comments about the University of Minnesota. First of all, I want to thank members of this committee and members of the House and Senate and the executive branch who have generously provided support for the university for so many years. The University of Minnesota is Minnesota's research and land-grant university. And unlike many other states, Minnesota only has one. We only have one such university. And I'd like to argue here this afternoon that it is one of the state's best assets, one of its most important treasures, if you will, and a critical statewide resource and an absolutely indispensable part of the state's future. That's not to denigrate in any way, shape, or form other private or public universities in Minnesota, but it is a valuable and, I think, very indispensable part of Minnesota's higher education system. Art Rolnick, the chair of the director of research for the Minnesota Federal Reserve, often asks the question of how Minnesota, a state that in the 1950s was lagging in terms of its progress in the national economy, emerged from that period of time to become one of the powerhouses, economic powerhouses in the nation. Its per capita income, rather than 29th as it was in 1958, is roughly 7th today. And based on any number of economic analyses, Minnesota clearly has one of the top performing economies in the nation and the world. And I would like to argue that the University of Minnesota has been a big part of that economic progress for the state of Minnesota, and I think it will be even more important to the state's future. Why is this such an important state asset, you might ask, and why is the university, in my judgment, so important to the state's future? Let me just give you a couple of things that I think are important to reflect upon. Every year, the faculty and staff of the University of Minnesota compete for and receive funding to support research and education well in excess of $500 million every year. That's 98% of all such funding that comes in to support research in higher education within Minnesota. That creates approximately $10 billion in Minnesota in economic activity in Minnesota's economy, produces a 16-to-1 rate of return for Minnesota's investment in the University of Minnesota, And the grants and contracts alone create 20,000 jobs in the private sector. The graduates of the University of Minnesota in a wide range of fields, but particularly healthcare, populate and provide two-thirds of the advanced healthcare professionals in every aspect of Minnesota's healthcare system. Doctors, pharmacists, veterinarians, specialists without whom the state's healthcare system could not thrive and operate at its very, very high level. It is also one of the leading centers of technology transfer in the United States today. And in any given year, you will find the University of Minnesota to be in the top 10 in terms of receipt of royalty income from research and discoveries. It has produced the leading antidote or drug to treat AIDS on a worldwide basis. Its apples, the Honeycrisp, are on their merry way to Australia and New Zealand. It has a phenomenal reach and impact through its research and through the transfer of technology. And so that's just one of many things that I think I would like to point out. But in sum, I think it's safe to say that a research university is absolutely indispensable in a world economy that depends on knowledge for its very vitality and survival. And we in the state of Minnesota, a population of roughly 5 million people, have created an incredible research university system with its campuses, its research stations, and, of course, its major center of research in the Twin Cities. Taking care of the university's facilities and capital investment, I think, is a wise investment for the state of Minnesota. And I want to say that the proposal you have before you today is one that we think is responsible and makes us a responsible steward of public resources. I want to say at the outset of my remarks that I do not think we can maintain the progress of the University of Minnesota, be responsible stewards of the public trust, with the capital budget levels that have been recommended in the governor's proposal to the House and Senate. This particular proposal is called Taking Care of What We Have. It's all about renewing our roofs, taking care of public safety, taking care of critical infrastructure, if you will, making modest progress in renewing important buildings and resources on various campuses of the University of Minnesota. It's all about renovating and revitalizing the campuses of the university and being good stewards at the same time. There's a songwriter by the name of Neil Young who once said, "Rust never sleeps." And I think that's what we think is important to reflect upon as we present this proposal to you. We have some of the oldest facilities in the state of Minnesota. They wear out. They weather. We have aging infrastructure that we need to maintain. And the proposal you have before you goes beyond mere maintenance. It really makes a real effort to take care of aging buildings, aging infrastructures, to improve the safety and efficiency of our operations, and, in short, to take care of what we have. The University of Minnesota has more than 800 buildings on all of its campuses and research stations. They are the oldest buildings in the state of Minnesota. 65% of them are 30 years or older. 25% of them are 75 years or older. We have over 100 buildings on the Twin Cities campus alone over 50 years old. We serve more than 85,000 students, faculty, and staff on the various campuses and offices of the University of Minnesota. Let me now take a few moments to introduce the 2004 capital request. And I want to draw your attention to this first slide. This first slide gives you a summary of the request that we think is modest and reasonable. The biggest part of this request, the major portion of our emphasis, is on what we call HEPRA. It's all about taking care of existing facilities and infrastructure. That's nearly 50% of the request, 48%. The next largest part of the request, and I'll go over each of these areas very briefly with you this afternoon, proposes to renew four critical buildings on various campuses of the University of Minnesota. That comprises nearly 40% of the request. We are proposing modest money to construct two new facilities, one in Morris and another at the University of Minnesota Duluth, with very substantial, in the latter case, substantial commitment, as I'll mention in a moment, from the students who attend that campus. And then we're asking for a very small amount of money for the 2006 request to underwrite and support some critical planning activity for important academic priorities. The major part of the request deals with the higher education asset and preservation and replacement part of the capital bonding. In this, we're asking for a total of $90 million covering approximately 100 projects. These projects are divided roughly into three broad areas. The first deals with critical health and safety issues, things that deal with accessibility, asbestos abatement, fire code compliance and sprinkler security improvements. And I must mention just very quickly in passing that many of these costs are directly responsive to the events of 9/11. The University of Minnesota and its campuses are considered major security concerns. We conduct a very important research that needs extraordinary security, and that's very much part of the health and safety request. The second part of the request deals with utility infrastructure, that's storm and water sewer improvements, heating and chilled water, plant expansion, particularly on the St. Paul campus, where we have a very critical need right now to increase our reliability as well as to reduce our cost, electrical distribution, and we have a critical need for a improvement in the electrical feed from the Xcel energy plant to the St. Paul campus. And then the final part of the HEPA request deals with building system repairs, and that's all the normal suspects, the usual suspects of waterproofing, roof replacement. A very critical part of the emphasis here is modest investments to improve our classrooms and also take care of building exteriors.
Mr. President, yes. If I could just ask you one question in terms of and this might be a difficult question to answer on the fly, but what if you could just give us some indication either now or after consulting with additionally with your staff, what percentage of the dollars you're talking about of this $90 million request would be done by university maintenance staff,
contractor,
and what percentage of it is contracted out?
I couldn't give you that now. I don't know that all of those decisions are made, but there are people here that could give you a much better answer.
Just a general estimate as to how much of it what you're obviously showing is in the photograph here is most likely one of the maintenance staff doing some painting, and again, so
yes.
Just some rough idea. Looks like there's some.
You know what?
An angel appearing over your shoulder.
I think there is, and I think he probably knows the details of this much better than I.
You want to introduce yourself, Orlin? I'm Orlin Miller from University Planning.
Welcome.
I don't have a precise breakdown, but the kind of things we include in HEPR do not include routine maintenance things, so I would say
like
better
paint.
Than 80% okay. of this would be jobs that would be in the by contractors in the market.
Okay, that's sufficient. Maybe while we're on the topic, could you just give us an idea in terms of the is there a dollar amount or some what pushes it from above and beyond what maintenance staff can do into a HEPA request, and therefore into most likely a contract being let for the work? Can you give us some general concepts?
I think it, Mr. Chair, I think it would have less to do with the dollar value than it would the complexity in what is being done. And if it's more construction-related versus maintenance, replacement of parts and that kind of thing, I suspect generally that a break point might be something in the $100,000 range, but I would hate to say that that's a break point because it so much depends on what the kind of work is being proposed.
just for the sake of the committee, maybe you could give us an example of something that would be done under maintenance versus something by complexity that would be contracted out.
Yes, Mr. Chair. Replacing parts of a fan component in an HVAC system, the belt, possibly a motor, would be done by maintenance staff. If it were replacing the entire unit, that would likely be contracted out for replacement.
But if you take, the, for example, the same, now you understand why I needed somebody to help me with the answer to your question. But if you take, for example, one of the major projects is the St. Paul chiller project in St. Paul, and that's a very complex project that would require, I think, outsourcing and or contracting externally. And, you know, a couple of these projects are fairly substantial and I think pretty urgent needs at the present time. Right now, all of the buildings on the St. Paul campus, including the new ones, are served, as I understand it, with separate facilities, and there is the opportunity to increase reliability, substantially reduce cost over time, and that's just one of many projects that are in this particular request.
President Brunig, said, to that point, I presume, maybe you can elaborate, how much of a cost analysis is done with repair versus replacement when you're going through this process?
Chair Kroenke, members of the committee, we have a very rigorous ongoing assessment process, and I actually think have a slide. We have a backup slide somewhere on this that shows the process. But there's a facility assessment, very detailed facility assessment that we do on an ongoing basis to determine, you know, how critical these projects are. They're all ranked very, very extensively. If we were to bring forward a request of all the possible needs, it would be considerably higher than this one. But we have to pay attention to the economics that have impact on the university, too. We just went through a pretty substantial budget reduction, and we have to watch our indebtedness as well as the as does the state. And so we try to find the right balance and address those things that are most urgent. And things that we can take care of with routine maintenance, we fund ourselves and do so on an ongoing basis. But it's a very rigorous assessment process where every aspect of every building is evaluated, and then the projects are rank ordered. I think Orlin and perhaps others could give you somewhat more detail. I don't know if that does justice to your question.
We did have people come in last year and explain to us what the process was, so we've gone through some of that. But I'm just looking at more of the general analysis that's done. But So anyway, I've taken you off track. So,
but
thank you.
This is an area that we'd be very pleased to provide you with additional documentation, additional information. We'd be very happy to do that. I'm quite proud of the work our people do, and we make an effort to refine those processes each and every year to benchmark those against the other institutions of higher education that we compete with, and we think it's a pretty sound process.
Thank you. If you could
We'd be happy to
then
supply the committee with additional information.
Appreciate that very much.
I need Cynthia to join me. I know real men do their own clicking, but I now happen to be one of them. Anyway, the next part of the request deals with what we have characterized in this presentation, major building renewal. And it's these projects, there are four of them, are projects in which we are making major HEPA investment, and then the university is issuing its own bonds to complete the projects, renew the buildings, and make them and bring them up to what we think are the appropriate standards of today. There are four key projects in this particular area. One is the Life Science Building in Duluth, and I'll mention a couple of things about that. Kolthoff Hall on the Twin Cities campus, the Education Sciences Building on the Twin Cities campus, and then the Academic Health Center educational facilities on the Twin Cities campus. Each of these supports very critical programs at the University of Minnesota. They all are focused on improving facilities that are I think, very much in need of renewal, repair, remodeling, if you will. And we feel this is a strategy to make the maximum possible impact for our investment and the investment of the state. The Life Science Building in Duluth, in my judgment, addresses one of the state's most urgent health care needs. We have a very critical shortage of pharmacists throughout the state of Minnesota, and that shortage, and those shortages, I should say, are particularly acute in areas of greater Minnesota. This establishes a new pharmacy program, not the building, but we have established a new pharmacy program in Duluth. It is now enrolling 52 students. At peak capacity, it will enroll approximately 160 students. The emphasis will be on preparing people for rural health care and placing pharmacists in greater Minnesota, much the way we have successfully done with the Rural Physicians Program, started many, many years ago in Duluth and now ranked as the top program of its kind in the country. This program maximizes the extent of collaboration between the University of Minnesota Duluth and the Twin Cities campus through the use of electronic communications, instructional television, video conferencing, and other technologies. The project also supports a very critical need to expand classroom and laboratory and teaching space for the biological science programs at the University of Minnesota Duluth. These programs have witnessed an 86% increase in majors just within the past 10 years in areas such as cell biology, biochemistry, molecular biology, and so this particular project, in our judgment, meets a very, very important statewide need at the present time. Kolthoff Hall is the Center for Teaching and Research for our Department of Chemistry. Over 500 faculty and staff use this facility. Approximately 11,000 students take chemistry courses each and every year. It's our largest PhD granting program. The faculty are extraordinarily productive in chemistry. They regularly bring in approximately $9 million of competitive grants and contracts on an annual basis. And it's one of our very, very strong departments, and I would argue that it's also foundational to so many academic areas of research and education across the University of Minnesota. This particular building is 35 years old. It has obsolete mechanical systems, ventilation and fume hoods to support the kind of work that is essential to do in modern chemistry research and educational programs. We think it's a very important ongoing investment, a critical project for us to support at this time, and very, very important not only to the university but the state as a whole. The next project is the Education Sciences Building. Some of you may know this as the former Mineral Resources Center. It's located on the Mississippi River. Approximately 40 to 50 faculty would occupy this particular building, and an additional 80 to 100 graduate students and researchers would be a part of this particular complex. It would house the Department of Educational Psychology, comprised of four academic units now that are spread across five different buildings, the Center for Applied Research and Educational Improvement, which has been a very successful consortium involving the University of Minnesota, other institutions of higher education, and the public schools, and the Center for Early Education and Development. This gives the university a chance to co-locate, to place faculty, staff, and students who are scattered in on-campus and off-campus rental facilities in one place to drive down operating costs, but it also does much more. I should also add that this is one of our very productive academic units in the university, one that brings in very substantial amounts of federal money, approximately $9 to $10 million a year on an annual basis. It does much more, though, for the university's campus. It allows us to free up space in other buildings and vastly improve the scope, availability, and quality of classrooms on the East Bank campus, a very critical need at the present time. It drives down, as I mentioned, operating costs. It frees up space in Elliott Hall, one of our better buildings, for the expansion of some critically important areas like developmental neuroscience, a field that is undergoing rapid expansion not only here but around the country. It's also going to provide a center for critically important research that I think is important to improve the vitality of Minnesota's schools and K-12 educational programs. For example, faculty in this building were very instrumental in the state of Minnesota receiving recently a $60 million grant to improve reading and literacy in the public schools, a grant that the governor announced, I think, early this fall. The fourth project in the renewal category is the Academic Health Center educational facilities. I believe these facilities are among the worst in the English-speaking world. I think they are below standard, clearly below the standards that we need to do modern health, modern education in the healthcare area. It would fix Mayo Auditorium, which is badly in need of repair. It's a major lecture hall. It serves all the different areas of the Academic Health Center. These classrooms serve at least 7,000 full-time equivalent students on an annual basis. It would fix classrooms and instructional labs throughout the Academic Health Center and also achieve some very important improvements in the Veterinary Teaching Center on the St. Paul campus. I mentioned that the University of Minnesota is responsible for the education, the preparation of leading healthcare professionals in the state of Minnesota, nearly 70% of them, and this allows the university to maintain its progress, to keep its competitive edge, to support the kind of education and through the use of technology that is so essential to modern education in this area. These are also students. These are places that serve students who pay very, very high rates of tuition and I think clearly deserve much better facilities.
Excuse one moment,
yes.
If you would, President Vernix. Representative Mahoney, you had a question?
I was wondering what the
on the St. Paul campus? Is that the Mineral Resource Center?
Yes.
This is now a vacant building. It is not one that can be used. It's a very bad eyesore on the riverbank, Mississippi River. But it's one with reasonable investment that can be brought up to modern standards. We think it's a building of rich historical significance to the university campus in the state of Minnesota, and we think it's a very good investment and has a tremendous beneficial domino effect on many other aspects of the Twin Cities. Yeah, it is vacant at the present time.
President Bernix, to that point, I wouldn't want any perhaps an architect to hear me say this, but having looked at the building, I'm not sure that it, at least in the eyes of this legislator, that it has any architecturally redeeming value. Can you tell us why you believe or why in the analysis this building is one to undergo major renovation other than to be replaced? Many times today, of course, renovation costs run almost as high as replacement costs just through methods of construction and obviously abatement of hazardous materials and the types of things. So can you give us a little further information as to how that decision was reached?
Chair Kroenke, members of the committee, we did do an analysis of remodeling versus replacement, and we felt the scales tipped in favor of remodeling the building, renovating the building on its current site. I actually think architecturally it will be splendid when this building is renewed, and I think it will be a spectacular addition to the Twin Cities campus. And we do have architectural, we've done some pre-design work on this particular building, and we do have the architectural renderings of what it would look like when remodeled. And I think it clearly will look very good from the other side of the river and from the interior campus side as well. It's really quite a magnificent building with lots of windows, and I think it will very nicely accommodate the uses that we have projected for it.
Just to follow up on that, President Brunks, if you could just, would appreciate having some not in-depth background as to what that analysis was, but some summary-level information on what that study showed, I think it would be helpful for committee members.
Mr. Chair, to Representative that point, Houseman. I asked the same question that you asked, and in addition to what the President said, I was further told that it has something to do with what's underneath the building.
It's foundation.
Underneath the building. Right. Well, not beyond that, and I maybe somebody's coming forward, and that taking that down, they did have a cost figure of $1 million or something like that, but that it's the complexity of what runs underneath that that complicates the project.
Mr. Chair, members, I think there are two questions to be responded to here. To the latter one, it being near the steam plant for the entire campus, there are major steam lines that go through the building, and they need to be protected whether or not we take the building down and replace it, take it down, or renovate the building. So that did factor into the discussion as to the investment it would take to protect those steam lines, depended on how we manage the building site. Relative to the question of what makes it reasonable to and feasible to renovate is largely due to the fact that the building is an industrial building that has large open space with a fairly flexible floor plate that was used at one time, as you know, for research, large machines, the crushed rock mineral research makes it very readily adaptable to putting even additional floor in the building. The large volume of space, we can relatively inexpensively put another floor, get square footage out of the building that exceeds what is in there now, and our adaptation to what is largely an office, seminar room, classroom-type building is relatively efficient and cost-effective.
Trusting your memory or your knowledge about what percentage of the building would be offices and what percentage would be classroom type seminar space?
Mr. Chair, I'm afraid that I would have to either look at a crib sheet or get that to you. I believe the office is probably about 75% of it, and the seminar space, it would be the remainder. I can confirm that for you.
We appreciate that.
I want to indicate that this is not the typical kind of classroom building. This is where people would be brought in seminar fashion, as I understand it, to do not only teaching but research in that type of environment.
Okay.
But I can certainly confirm that.
We'd appreciate, we trust your memory, but it said, obviously, crib notes help. So.
Yeah. Chair Kringy, this is a department that mainly serves graduate students, not only in this particular department but across the campus. And so the need for large classroom spaces is not as great in this particular building as might be the case in some other areas. Secondly, the real classroom advantage is by opening up other spaces in Elliott Hall, Pike Hall, in other parts of the campus to solve critical classroom shortages that we have on the East Bank at the present time. So it has this effect of moving people out of some spaces that can be very efficiently converted to classrooms and moving other people into spaces that are vacated in areas that are growing rapidly and areas that we cannot accommodate at the present time. And so it has a beneficial domino effect that runs in several different directions at once. And we felt this was the most cost-effective way to solve several problems at the same time.
Yeah. Representative Knobloch has a question.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. President Brunix or Mr. Miller, is there some reason that the cost figure on these projects isn't split precisely two-thirds and one-third. I look at this, and the U of M contribution is more than one-third. I looked at the project before, and I think it was less than one-third. Is there some reason that we're not strictly going along with the usual one-third debt service requirement?
Chair Krenke, Representative Knobloch, I think this cluster of projects, though, has roughly a one-third contribution. And I,
in total, I think
yes,
that's probably right. But is there some reason the individual ones don't?
I think we can answer that. Let me ask Mr. Fitzenreiter how these numbers were calculated.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, the university, when it worked on this capital request last fall, we bring it to the board in the September-October timeframe. And previous, a few months previous to that, we were modeling the budget plan around how much of the individual buildings related to the kind of things, excuse me, that would relate to HEPR-type improvements. And the remaining part of the building, to do the programmatic improvements, the university would do through its resources. We discussed that with the chairs, with Representative Krenke at a time when he came to visit the campus. We discussed it with Commissioner McElroy at the time and with Senator Langseth. And subsequent to that discussion and our turning in our capital request, we felt that perhaps that was stretching the notion of what HEPR was all about. And we did not go in and modify our request, but if you look at the governor's budget recommendations for three of these projects, he adjusted those numbers to reflect the more accurate traditional one-third, two-thirds, and the university hasn't any issue with that change.
Thank you.
Okay. Representative Mahoney?
Okay. Chair Krenke, one of the things that should be said is that the bonds to complete these projects would be issued by the University of Minnesota rather than the state. That's, we think this is, for the University of Minnesota, a more creative way to plan projects of this type that require major remodeling and renewal. And it is a somewhat of a departure from how we've approached these requests in the past. But, we think it's breaking some new ground, and it makes these requests more understandable, but I also think it gives you an opportunity to actually increase the state's bonded indebtedness and improve the situation for all of us, but I suspect you might not think of it quite the same way.
Before Mr. Fitzenreiter gets too far away, I just one quick question that speaking of that, what is the current debt at the university?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, the outstanding debt at the University of Minnesota on December 31st was $668 million. Our average interest rate on debt issued by the university is approximately 4.37%, and the average duration, length of time of all of that debt, that $668 million, which also includes the one-third that you've sold for us in years past, the average duration is about 13 years. So our interest rates are relatively low. We sell it for roughly 20 years, and we pay it off very quickly. In fact, given that I'm sort of a creature of the state, our approach to debt very much mirrors your approach to debt. Get the lowest interest rate, pay it off as fast as you can, and recycle it.
Appreciate the information right off the top of his head. Very good.
So that's why he's the chief financial officer. Turning now to another part of the request, that is much smaller part of the request deals with new facilities, and there are two of these. One is the Sports and Health Center proposed addition at the University of Minnesota Duluth. This is a campus that has substantially increased its enrollment over the past 10 years. It's an enrollment level that I know is sustainable and will stay at a very, very high level. Duluth, as you know, is becoming a highly regarded part of Minnesota's higher education system and a destination campus for students not only in Minnesota but many other states as well. At the present time, the recreation sports facilities for students on the Duluth campus serve about 55% of the need. We clearly have serious undercrowding and scheduling problems. This project was initiated by the students. They voted to assess themselves for one-third of the debt on this particular building. You might ask the question, why didn't we stick them with all the debt? There are examples on campuses in Minsku and the University of Minnesota where some of these facilities have been totally funded by students, and some of them have been totally funded by the state, and some of them have been funded through various combinations of state, student, or university contribution. I felt, along with the university's Board of Regents, that this was a tough time for students and families. We were increasing their tuition very, very highly in this particular period of time due to the state budget shortfall and the kind of soft economy we all have. So I felt that this kind of a participation was a reasonable thing at this particular time. And my sense is this is a critically important project, not only for the Duluth campus, but I think also to provide these students with the kind of quality of experience that they have a right to deserve. These facilities now are operated nearly on a 24-hour-a-day basis, and they're just very much in a state of overcrowding. The next project is a relatively small project. It's from the University of Minnesota Duluth. The total project cost is $8 million. The state participation is about 5.3. I think this is an outstanding partnership that involves the city of Morris, the K-12 school district, and the University of Minnesota Morris. It provides a backup heating and utility plant that burns alternative biomass fuels that are readily available in the local area. Waste wood, corn screenings, and other materials. It's environmentally sound. I think it breaks new ground in terms of experimenting with renewable energy in an area where the state of Minnesota, I believe, should be a national and international leader. It is projected to save annual landfill costs by about $150,000 a year. And it's also an important area of research and development for the University of Minnesota. This particular project also provides for a shared football facility that is between the high school and the University of Minnesota Morris. The football facility or field must be moved because of the construction of the plant. The local community has passed a referendum to provide $1 million of support. I should say that this is the only shared use stadium that I'm willing to support at the present time. But anyway, I thought you might ask that question. But anyway, I think this is a very creative project, a great example of a community partnership. Also, it positions the university and this community in an area where I think we need to assume economic leadership for the future. These last two facilities, that is the Rec Sports and Health Center in Duluth and the biomass and football field in Morris, were not recommended by Governor Pawlenty and his recommendations to the House and Senate. Thank you.
Excuse me, President Brunick. So we have a question from Representative Hausman on one of these projects.
Yes.
And I actually have an observation on the previous one, if you can go back to that. This is for our members. I think tomorrow, when we've got all the Minsku projects before us, if some of those sports centers, they're kind of all over the map in terms of what the expectation is about the local match. So we might just keep this particular these numbers in mind as we're hearing all of those facilities tomorrow, because it seems to me if we're talking about sports centers, there ought to be some sort of common expectation across both University of Minnesota and Minsku. But to the other project then, just to try to make a little sense of the numbers and impact on this sheet, and you referenced the plant will also provide steam and chilled water to Morris High School, elementary school, and potentially to a nearby community hospital.
And the camp.
There are immediate cost savings because the cost per BTU is less. Eliminating the need for the school district to construct their own heating and cooling plant. There's a referendum for $1 million locally for that joint-use football field. Costs will be shared by both parties. Steam and chilled water will be provided to the school district. All of those suggest that, one, there's revenue raise in this. That we assume that there's got to be some sort of contribution from the local levels. But it also suggests cost savings. And when I get to the summary sheet, what I don't see in a variety of areas, and maybe it's just referenced somewhere else, there's a line called local government funds. I don't know if that's where revenue should show up. In that bottom, where it says changes in state operating costs, where building operating expenses, they go up.
We have the same notebooks, and I just don't have those sheets in front of me. But that's all right. Go ahead and continue.
What I'm wondering is where in the numbers, our summary numbers, do we show that there is revenue generated from some of those local governments? Shouldn't that show up? And if we're saving money, their immediate cost savings, why do operating expenses go up, especially since it also says no additional university faculty results? So it's that reflection of that local partnership seems to me somehow that's got to be reflected here.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hausman, I will give that one a try. If I understood the question as I was consulting back there, it's primarily as to where the revenue shows up in here. On the capital side, school district has passed a referendum, or the community has passed a referendum to put $1 million into the joint project. That's their capital contribution to this. The revenue toward the operation will be, they will actually purchase the energy, chilled water, and steam to run their particular facilities, which will be paid to the universities at operating plus some amount that would cover any kind of depreciation and maintenance on those items. So the revenue would come from the sale of the energy itself.
And my only question, and I see that's clear in the text. I don't see it reflected in the numbers. Shouldn't that revenue show up somewhere?
In the numbers, at least as we interpreted that, it is simply the capital costs. The program operating costs, I suppose it might have been calculated in there. That's not the way we interpreted to provide the data.
Chair Gringy, Representative Hausman, my assumption is that those fuel costs are in the operating budgets of the different partners that are going to access this facility. For example, we have in our budget, fuel utility costs. We're always trying to drive those costs down. Now, the difficulty is, how do you capture, it seems to me, the $150,000 a year in cost savings from landfill use? And that's not capturable in the normal sense of the word, because it's paid by so many different people who, deposit fuels that can be burned in this plant from a variety of sources, farmers, local business people, and others. So we don't have a good way of capturing, if that's what you meant, I don't think we have a good way of capturing those revenues. We know there are cost savings to the community. We have pretty good ways, I think, of estimating that. But the other sort of revenues to sustain and renew and remodel the project and to purchase fuels would come through the normal operating budgets of all the partners.
Is that roughly accurate?
Close enough for university work, as we say.
Mr. Chair,
I think we'll just have to work that out. I mean, it does seem as though somehow, like even at $1 million,
the $1 million is being contributed to the one-third contribution.
It's just confusion, and we can, I mean, it probably doesn't warrant.
I think it's a good question.
It just strikes us as somehow the text and the numbers don't quite work on this one.
The, Mr. Chair, the form being part of the state's capital request, they identify specifically capital costs and personnel costs that are involved with this. It does not, at least in our interpretation, did not allow a calculation for the operating, the fuels and the energy costs, which is where the big savings occurs.
But we can certainly
expand on that.
Yeah, we can certainly get back with a more refined response to your question, Representative Hausman, and be pleased to do so.
President,
yes.
Two questions regarding these projects. First, with regard to the sports and health center addition at UMD, why is it that in some cases you are coming with this project, for example, to seek state funding, whereas with the Kauffman Union Student Center, there was no request for state bonds to renovate that facility? What is the difference between, say, a Kauffman on the Minneapolis campus and the Sports Health Center at UMD?
Chair Craigie, I think this is a very good question, and it reminds me of a long conversation I had with then-Commissioner McElroy on the same subject. And I do think Representative Hausman's observation is correct, that colleges and universities in Minsku and the University of Minnesota systems have used different ways, different strategies over the years of funding such facilities. On some campuses, the state has provided funding for hockey facilities, and the students have assessed themselves for recreation supports facilities. And on the Twin Cities campus, for example, the big expansion of rec sports facilities was funded with student assessments. Kauffman was funded by student assessments. The expansion of facilities in some areas were through a combination of a partnership with the state and students, as well as university funding. So we have used a variety of strategies, I think all of us, over the years. It could be beneficial to come to some agreement as to how to handle these projects in the future. I do think in these times when we're hitting students and families with extraordinary double-digit tuition increases on a multi-year basis, it was reasonable to approach this project in this particular fashion. In the case of Kauffman, we felt there was it was before we started to really ratchet up tuition. We did some significant double-digit increase that year. But it seemed to us to be a more affordable long-term project for the students to fund, and therefore we did it on that basis. If I was to face the same prospect today, I'm not sure how I would approach it, to be honest with you. So I think it's mostly out of a concern for the kind of total cost, the burden of total attendance, the cost of total attendance on students, that led us to feel that this was a reasonable division of responsibility on this particular project. I think this project is very, very important to providing the students at UMD with a reasonable quality of life. About 90% of the students on the campus are very, very active and make use of the rec sports facilities, and they're strictly inadequate to sustain the level of service that I think the students deserve. But this is a reasonable policy question, and one that we wrestled with. We thought about a great deal, but I just felt under the circumstances, along with members of our Board of Regents, that this was a reasonable proposal to submit in this form at this time.
President Brewings, if we could again make a request, I appreciate your response, but with all of the brain power you have, maybe you could forward some potential suggestions to us as to how this dilemma might be, modeled, mm-hmm. as to what portion of what is essentially student activities is funded by student fees, and which facilities would best be supported either through the campus, either through U of M bonds or MNSCU share of indebtedness. Again, I think it's, you're right. We've had various approaches. It would probably be helpful to at least start to consider what is a likely model. And I see Chairman Stang over here is taking copious notes on the issue of, but if you could forward both to higher ed committees, House and Senate, and to I think Capitol committees as well, at least the outline of what might be a policy. We can all start working on that now rather than later.
We'd be happy to give it a try. I think if you look at how colleges and universities have funded these buildings and opportunities for students over the past, you'd find that the students have paid more than their fair share. I think they've really stepped up. For example, in the case of Kauffman Union, which I think is a very fine result for the Twin Cities campus, the students are on the hook for that entire project, or at least most of it. There's a part of it that deals with academic needs of the entire campus that is funded in another way, but most of it is funded by student assessments and student contributions. And the students were, it was discussed with the students, and they very, very strongly supported it. But you're right, there is a good deal of inconsistency in how systems and campuses have approached these issues over the past few years. I think I've given what I think is a reasonable rationale for the way we approached it. I didn't think it was reasonable for the university to pay the one-third. The students are the primary beneficiaries, so I thought they ought to step up, and they did. And they actually took the initiative and took the leadership on this building.
Representative Mahoney, you have a question?
Well, I was just going to ask if
Representative Mahoney, if you could pull your mic over just so we want to make sure you get recorded on tape for perpetuity.
Yeah, just what I want. thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. President, could you include in that projection or those figures that you give the percentage that, of increase in tuition that it would cost to do that, so that we know if we're going to switch funds from one to another, how much we're going to put that on students and parents?
Yes. Chair Cranky, Representative Mahoney, I'd be happy to do that because I think that's and we have those data because we actually modeled it, and it obviously would increase that burden considerably. But we'll send that along.
I just want to know if I have to recuse myself because my daughter's applying.
We'll take that into consideration, Representative Mahoney.
She didn't have any representation for the one-third debt she would inherit if this project goes into effect.
I'm not worried about her debt inheriting.
President Bruins, just again, if I could just sort of drift into the second question, some which you alluded to earlier, shared sports facilities, which is a portion of what the request at Morris is for the shared football facility. And of course, again, the question arises is when does the university, under what model do you operate as to what should be a shared cost facility, what is a facility that is funded totally by the university, such as some of the other projects you've had in the past? How do you approach that issue?
Chair Greenkey, members of the committee, I think what we have done is tried to approach each project and determine the real value of the project, the importance to the campus and the university as a whole, and then tried to figure out the best, most equitable funding formula. And again, I think it falls into the same category as the Duluth facility. We have used different strategies. What makes this one different? Actually, I find this project somewhat, not somewhat, but quite inspiring, because I have long felt and have long recommended these kinds of community partnerships throughout Minnesota, including for areas of the Twin Cities. I think it's a great outcome when a community, a school district, and a campus can come together and figure out how to use local resources in the most, most creative fashion. And I was quite enthusiastic, as was the Board of Regents, about this particular project. And it just seemed to us that the community stepped up and participated. The university is funding its share of the project, and it seemed to us overall that it was one of those common goods that made sense for us to support. I suspect we'd use a somewhat different model for what I hope will be an on-campus Gopher football stadium in the Twin Cities. But we're just going to have, I don't know that we can create a simple formula, but I do think it's probably worth revisiting these issues. But I think this is one of those projects where we've got so many benefits coming together in one project, some benefits that have to do with thinking through and experimenting with renewable energy, an area that I think represents a great future for the state of Minnesota, combined with the kind of research and investment we're making here at the University of Minnesota, partnership with the community where resources and common utilities and infrastructure are shared in a creative fashion. My sense is we ought to encourage a lot more of that. I think we do too much sort of separate construction. We don't do enough sharing of public investment the way that I think we could. So I don't know. It seemed to us that this was the best way to do it, and the community really stepped up and provided the lion's share of the funding for the football field, and we thought that was a good way to approach this particular project.
Representative Houseman.
To the bigger question of that other joint project, since both us, I represent both the City of Falcon Heights and the State Fairgrounds, and both of those entities have met with me recently. Every time it appears in the newspaper that they're going to be host to this joint facility between the university and the Vikings, both entities have assured me they want no part of that, and I would just happily invite the president to help me assure those communities that won't be imposed upon them.
Chair Kroenke, Representative Houseman, I can assure you unequivocally it is not part of the university's plans for the future to locate a football facility on the fairgrounds or close to Falcon Heights. We think the best place to locate that stadium is just east of Mariucci Arena on the east bank of the Twin Cities campus. But this is a big project. It's one that's going to take a lot of creativity and a lot of hard work. It may be a bridge too far. I think it's something we can do, but we're just going to have to test it out, see if it's feasible, see if there's enough interest among private citizens and businesses in helping us raise private funds. I think a substantial part of this should be privately financed, and that's what we're exploring at the present time. But I have talked to the leaders in your district about this issue, and at least for the time being, and I think for the foreseeable future, we share their point of view.
Okay. But we'll let you get back on
track. Let me sort of like I have a little plaque in my office that goes something like this. I finally got it all together, but I forgot where I put it, and I've got to go back and see if I can resurrect where I was in my comments. I think I'm on the new facilities part, which is a very, very small part of this request, and this deals with planning money for two business schools, one in the Twin Cities, not a business school, a business school expansion in the Twin Cities and at the University of Minnesota Duluth. These are areas where we've had substantial increases in enrollment pressure in the last several years, where facilities are inadequate. In the case of the Twin Cities campus, it represents an opportunity to expand enrollment in one of the nation's leading business schools. I should add that in both the case of the University of Minnesota Duluth and on the Twin Cities campus, the students who are making application to our business schools are among the very best students we recruit to our various campuses. So these are two small projects that would come forward in a subsequent request to the University of Minnesota, It's it would provide critically important planning money to do the pre-design work, the engineering work, to prepare the proposals for a 2006 request. One final comment: in both of these cases, the university has been successful at UMD and on the Twin Cities campus in attracting private dollars to help support some of the costs of these buildings, and so there's a good deal of private sector interest in these projects and financial commitment to go along with them.
President Brunix, to that point, I know that as in the past, these are sometimes rather finite donations, or they have time limits on them. Can you shed any further light as to whether these are finite or fixed types of pledges, donations toward these projects?
Yes, Chair Craig, members of the committee, in the case of Duluth, there's a $4.5 million commitment. In the case of the Twin Cities, there's a $10 million long-term private commitment. The donors have not given us a fixed deadline. We have had gifts in the past where donors have said to us, I'm willing to make a financial commitment of X dollars, but the building must, the construction must start on X date, must be finished by X time. But as far as I know, that is not, we don't have any restrictions of that kind on these particular gifts. But these are these are two gifts made by very distinguished graduates of UMD and the Twin Cities campus, people who have been quite successful in life and want to give something back to the University of Minnesota. In both of these cases, it would vastly improve the capacity of our classrooms on, in the case of the Twin Cities, on the West Bank, and in the case of Duluth, in the center of the campus. Well, let me just make a couple of final comments, if I might. First of all, I'd like to emphasize once again that we felt it was important, and I think we lived up to this expectation to come forward with a reasonable, modest request, one that really stated the university's needs and what the university absolutely needed at this time. We think this request is essential to maintaining the strength and the quality of the university. We call it a workhorse request, not a show horse request. It clearly could have been much, much larger, but in these times, with the kind of pressures we have, we felt we needed to find a reasonable middle course. The philosopher Eric Hoffer, a longshoreman, once said, "You can tell the quality of a civilization or a community by the kind of attention it pays to its own maintenance." And that's why we decided to call this request Taking Care of What We Have. If you have visited the campuses of the University of Minnesota, and I would argue the Twin Cities campus in particular, let's say in the 1980s, you would have seen a campus where people had not taken sufficient care of what we had. If you visit Duluth, Morris, Crookston, or the Twin Cities today, you will see campuses where people really have paid attention and tried to make every possible effort to renew them and keep them in the kind of condition I think that is worthy of our students, our faculty and staff, and the citizens of this state. The third point I guess I'd like to make is that we feel our campuses, the university as a whole, has really been undergoing a renaissance in recent years. We think we've really made some progress. There is not a day that goes by, or hardly a week that goes by, that I do not receive a card, a letter, or a phone call from parents who have taken their kids around the United States, had them visit colleges and universities, public and private, and come back with the observation that the Twin Cities campus, or the Duluth campus, or the Morris or the Crooks campus are the nicest and most attractive campuses they visit. We think that's important. If you don't have pride in your institution, if you don't take care of what you have, I think you can't attract students, you can't keep top quality students, you certainly can't attract and keep top quality faculty that I think are absolutely essential to the long-term vitality of this state. And I think increasingly, because we have paid attention to the university and its resources, we are attracting the interest of private donors, people who have benefited and have had a transforming experience by going to our colleges and universities, and now are coming back and are willing to help the state, to help the University of Minnesota by making very important private gifts, gifts like the gift we received from William and Nadine McGuire to develop the Translational Research Facility, a partnership with the state of Minnesota, the University of Minnesota, and this generous gift from the McGuires, a gift without any strings attached to it whatsoever except to go out and do good thing, develop cures to some of the most dreaded diseases of our time. We really need a strong partnership with the state of Minnesota. I must tell you, I am disappointed with the governor's recommendation on our capital request, and I have said so publicly. I think we need to do better. We are now living through a very difficult period in which we've taken a 15% state reduction. I believe the highest such reduction given to a public system in the United States last year. That was also true of Minsky, I might add. It's not just unique to the University of Minnesota. It caused us to increase tuition at very, very high levels. We had to freeze wages and salaries, push more health care cost increases to our employees. We sustained a strike. We cut 550 employees from the university payroll. And we've had to cut and restructure in a very substantial way many valued programs of the University of Minnesota. I think we went about our work apolitically. We went about it strategically. We didn't whine from the tallest building in the metropolitan area or any other place in the state. But I can tell you quite honestly, and I believe this very strongly with all my colleagues in the university's Board of Regents, that continued underfunding of higher education in general and continued underfunding of the University of Minnesota will move us from what I consider to be major league status, the case of the university's Twin Cities campus, one of the top public research universities in America, one of the most public productive universities created by a population with less than 5 million people, an extraordinary achievement by this state. It'll move us from major league status very quickly to what I consider to be minor league status. We've committed our own resources in this particular plan. We've gone out and raised private funds to support many of these requests. I think the request is very modest. It focuses on the right things at the right time. And I urge you to give this a very, very strong consideration in the weeks and the couple of months ahead. We clearly need your support. We have enjoyed an extraordinary partnership for 153 years with the citizens of this state, with the members of the House and the Senate, and previous governors and this one. And this kind of support is going to be absolutely critical to keeping the university vibrant and strong for the future. And I would argue keeping this state's quality of life and economy as one of the best in the world. So with that, let me finish my presentation. We need your partnership. We need your help. We need to preserve and strengthen this core asset of the state of Minnesota. And I really appreciate this chance to come and spend some time, Representative Krenke, with you and members of the committee. And I'd be very happy to take additional comments and questions at this time.
Well, if no one else wants to jump in, the chair, as usual, always has an additional question. You didn't mention the University of Minnesota Mayo Joint Partnership and the research facility in Rochester, which is, I guess, being, as they say, officially being proposed by the governor. But the issue, as I understand it, is that this is money that would be, appropriated to the regents for this research facility. So I guess I'd like to have your comment, and also in terms of, as you phrased it here, taking care of what we have doesn't necessarily fit into your overall agenda.
Yeah. Chair Krenke, members of the committee, it's a fair question. I must say that this is not a priority in the university's capital request, but I personally feel, and I believe many others do, that this is a very good state investment. I think this a growing and I would argue flourishing academic partnership involving the University of Minnesota and Mayo Clinic was stimulated and supported very strongly by Governor Pawlenty. I think it's a very smart thing to do for the university, for Mayo and the state of Minnesota. So I think it's a very good economic investment, but we did not make it, nor should we make it, part of the priorities of the university's capital request. But we indicated that we would be willing to host the budget, the budget allocation, and so I'm not prepared to say it's a priority in our capital request, and I'm not prepared here today to say that I would trade anything on our list for this building, and I won't do that. But I do think it's it is a capital request and a proposal that I believe the state should consider, and I think it is in the best interest of the state to support it. Let me just say one other thing, and I know people differ a great deal. I had an interesting conversation with a major CEO in the metropolitan area, and he made an observation that I think is very important. He made this kind of an observation. He said, many times when you're dealing with the reduction in operating costs and you're trying to drive down your operating costs, that is precisely the time when the conditions are right to engage in prudent, thoughtful, and strategic capital investment. I think we are in that kind of an era and that kind of a period right now. We have historically low interest rates. We have a soft economy that allows you to get good prices and good bids on projects. And I think this is a time for Minnesota to invest. I'm obviously more than a little biased when it comes to making this argument. But I think it's precisely in these times when you're going through a tough period when you need to kind of look over the fence, you need to look down the road, you need to make kind of investments that are going to set the university, and I would argue the state, on a strong and vibrant course for the future. But I know people differ, and I know you've got a lot of arguments and struggles over how high this bill should be and what projects should be funded. I think it is a time when we should step back. I don't think we should take imprudent chances on our future, but I do think we ought to stretch a little bit, particularly at a time when we've hammered our operating budgets so hard, and we have an opportunity through our capital investment to absorb some of those operating cost reductions and move the state forward at the same time. That's more than an answer than I think your question requested of me.
Well, let me pose another question, Dr. Burns, that I posed last week to Dr. Sarah and Dr. Smith with regard to the partnership, and I ask, should there be an annulment or a divorce, who gets the children?
Well, this is one of those partnerships made in heaven. It's not going to come unglued. We can't start out with that notion. Actually, I think this is not a new partnership. If you look now at and you look at the history of Mayo Clinic and the University of Minnesota, there have always been strong research partnerships and even educational partnerships involving these two great institutions. Preceding Governor Pawlenty's call for a strengthening of this relationship between Mayo and the University of Minnesota, I can say that Provost Mazur, Vice President Sarah, Senior Vice President Sarah, and I made many, many trips to Rochester working on these academic partnerships. And so I don't think there's any chance that we're going to have an annulment or a divorce here. I think what makes these things work, to be honest with you, is self-interest and common interest. And these two great institutions, with their unparalleled research and educational capacity, have the potential to keep Minnesota as one of the leading edge innovators when it comes to healthcare research, the finding solutions to human diseases, and the combination of these academic strengths from the University of Minnesota and Mayo Clinic is a highly complementary relationship, And I have a sense that it'll continue to grow. What I was just absolutely amazed about, and I would think Dr. Sarah Smith would say the same thing, is we only put out this call for proposals to see what kind of interest the researchers would have, and I was absolutely overwhelmed by the kind of response we got and the quality of response that we have. And this is sort of the kind of thing you see in the private sector and the public sector happening all around us, and that is the people who often normally compete are finding new ways to cooperate to create new synergisms, new opportunities. So I don't really think that's going to happen. And even if the worst case did occur, the state of Minnesota would be still well served by having this addition in the Rochester community. But I don't think there's any chance of that happening, quite honestly.
Most people walk down the aisle never believe they're going to get
to
the
I know
that.
I know it.
As I said, not necessarily a fair question, Dr. Brunix, but one,
The thing that I will say, just one thing, one of the things that I feel very good about, and this was an agreement we struck in a meeting in Rochester, and that is that what we put into this initiative has to bring back multiple returns for the state of Minnesota. So we said to these faculty members that you can get seed grants, but you need to write grants to the federal government, to private foundations. You need to grow Minnesota's investment in you. And that's what I think we need to keep our eye on. This is an economic development investment that I think makes some sense. But I must hasten to add, it's not a facility that we will use each and every day. It will certainly support this academic partnership and the researchers of the University of Minnesota, but it's not a capital priority of the University of Minnesota at this time.
I'm sorry, Representative Mahoney.
And to that point, Mr. Chair, it just so happened, it's a good thing I did go through my mail kind of haphazardly as you were speaking, because the Representative Bradley and I both sat through the economic qualification study for our $30 million investment, plus a little bit of change here and there. And just so that the other members, and I'm sure that this is available, all you have to do is ask for it, but they're talking on this $30 million investment in Rochester. In a mid-range scenario, by the year 2010, they're talking approximately 4,000 new jobs to the state and an economic impact of very close to $300 million. And if you extend it out to, I think it's 15 years, it's an economic impact of almost $1 billion and over 12,000 jobs. Certainly has some investment. As a businessman, as a good businessman that you are, knowing that kind of a return would certainly even impress you, Mr. Chairman, and hopefully it will impress the other members of the committee. It certainly impressed me, as I had to sit through it twice. And I'm sure before the year is out, before session is out, I'll get a third opportunity.
Yeah.
But you should probably make this available to the other members of the committee. It's very, for a non-business guy, it's actually interesting reading even for me. But I think it's I'd like to support you on that, and I don't think it should count against your University of Minnesota priorities, because it really is an economic development project as opposed to a project that enhances higher learning for our students.
Chair Kriegel, Representative Mahoney, if I could just, I'd like to add to what Representative Mahoney has said so well, and that is there are many states around the country that are investing very, very heavily in what they call the biosciences, biotechnology revolution. I don't think all of these investments are very wise, to be quite frank about it. My sense is you need to invest in where you have strength, and comparative strength. There are a lot of states that are just dumping hundreds of millions of dollars out there hoping that something will stick and they'll be able to make their states a center of the biosciences revolution. In the state of Minnesota, you have an extraordinary biosciences capacity in the area of energy, medical devices, with two of the world's great research centers in human health. You have a great agriculture school, a veterinary school, for example, in the area of cancer research. Some of the most promising breakthroughs are coming because people are connecting foods, nutrition, animal health to human health. These are areas where Minnesota can be truly a world leader. And I think we have to be prudent, particularly given the financial circumstances we have in our state, but I think we also have to take some calculated risks and invest in some areas where we know we already have a track record, we have proven entities, and we have, I think, great prospects to keep Minnesota as one of the strong economies in the country. The economy of Minnesota is very, very strong today. It's going to lag a little bit in this recovery, but to have a per capita income that's fifth to seventh in the United States when it was in roughly 30th in the 1950s, and to have an economy which is so well positioned in this global marketplace with agriculture and food production and a very heavy investment in medical research and technology, science and technology, I think we're in a good position, but it's something you can lose overnight if you don't keep investing in the right things. And I know I'm a true believer. I believe that these are areas of investment that are critically important to not only our University of Minnesota and Minsky, and but also I would argue the state of Minnesota as well. So I think this is a good project. You'll have to figure out whether you have room in the budget to support it. But I do think long-term, as we go into the biennial section, as we think about the state's future, I hope you'll give some thought to how you want to position this state. I can argue that there will be a very dim future for the university, for the state of Minnesota, without a strong investment in the University of Minnesota. I believe a research university is right in the center of a knowledge-based, innovation-based economy, especially one that finds itself competing in a world marketplace.
President Bruins, thank you. Appreciate
it's great to be here.
Time, now, but we can't let you slip away without one last difficult question. And again, I applaud the university for the partnership with Mayo and the progress you've made to date. And we know that's certainly, again, obviously moving in the right direction. And if the the study that Representative Mahoney is any indication, it certainly would be a huge economic driver for the state of Minnesota. More specifically to the point of investments and to keeping the university's mission on track, and again, I know that this might not necessarily be a fair question, but you have four major building renewals that you have presented. And I guess one of the difficult things that this committee is going to have to do is to make some priority decisions. Of those four renewal projects, I guess you don't need to answer this now. We could, but at some point we would appreciate if you could give us some priorities as far as which of those projects you deem to be at the top of the list. Obviously, we're going to do our best to try to fund as much of the keeper and renewal of these buildings as we possibly can, but it would be beneficial for us to have a little bit greater insight as to which you feel have the greatest priority on your agenda.
Well, Chair Kroenke, I hope you'll stretch to the maximum possible degree, and I know you will, I will say this, that we have presented our request this year in priority order, and we'd be happy to come back and work with the committee on that issue. I think all of these building renewal projects are absolutely essential to the university, and so I'll push very, very hard to see if we can get all of those funded. But I know you have some very difficult things to manage and juggle here. The sky is not the limit. You can obviously spend double what is recommended by the governor and not please everyone in the state of Minnesota. So I understand your circumstance and the dilemmas that you face, but we'll be happy to work with the committee.
We appreciate that very much. Again, the other information as we go through here, obviously, if any of these projects could potentially be staged, I mean, I certainly am fully cognizant of what you mentioned at the outset. You have a number of buildings over 50 years old. You have a tremendous amount of asset preservation work.
Yes.
And maintenance to do just to keep all of these buildings functional and operational. So we always appreciate the fine work that the maintenance staff does in order to keep it keep the place functioning. So again,
we'll be happy to look at those issues too. There are times when you can stage a project, and we always assess the extent to which projects can be staged, and that's another area where we could talk to you about it.
If there are no further questions, President and all the other members of the university, appreciate very much your time today.
Well, thank you very much.
We have some other business members of the approval of the minutes from the 10th, the 11th, the 17th, and the 18th of February. Representative Hausman, would you be so kind as to move the approval of the minutes from those meetings?
No.
They have been moved. Any additions, corrections, deletions? If not, all those in favor of approval of the minutes signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those who are opposed, the minutes are approved. Members, next week, we have no committee meeting on Tuesday, obviously because of precinct caucuses. However, I want to warn you that we are going to start receiving reports from finance committees hopefully next week, and we may need to schedule meetings in the evening on Thursday or potentially on Friday morning. So our scheduling is going to get more challenging as we go forward. So the easy times are behind you, members, and tough times about to face us. So with that, meeting is adjourned.